New Horizons is sponsored in part by the Idaho Humanities Council, deepening understanding of human experience by connecting people with ideas.
Today on New Horizons, Jason Herbick, a Boise State French professor who survived the recent earthquake in Haiti.
The initial earthquake, for me at least, it seemed like it was quite strong, followed by a very strong one seconds later, followed by another, and it was during the second phase of that first earthquake that the walls started cracking and everything. I did not see any search and rescue where I was, and we traveled through Port-au-Prince quite a bit in the 3-4 days I was there. I didn't see any except at the airport. No longer did I close the door when going to the bathroom. I slept on a couch 10 feet from the door. I was obviously in a state where I wasn't going to take any chances.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons. The catastrophic earthquake that struck Haiti on January 12th left a trail of destruction and death in its wake, with many thousands killed, 2 million left homeless, and widespread destruction of buildings and infrastructure. The challenges facing Haiti are daunting. The ongoing assistance of international aid agencies will be critical to helping the country rebuild in the weeks, months, and years ahead. Today's guest, Boise State professor Jason Herbick, was in Haiti when the earthquake struck. We're thankful Dr. Herbick survived, unharmed, and that he has safely returned back home. Dr. Herbick is the French section head in our Department of Modern Languages and Literature. He joined Boise State's faculty in 2005. He earned a bachelor's and Ph.D. from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a master's degree from Middlebury College. All of his degrees are in French literature. I've invited Jason on our program today to talk about his experiences in Haiti. Jason Herbick, welcome to New Horizons, and most importantly, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start from the beginning. You were only in Port-au-Prince a very short time before the earthquake struck, and I guess I'm just curious, had you traveled to Haiti before? Did you know anything about the country other than what most of us hear about Haiti in the international media?
No, in fact, it was my first time there, and going there for the first time, I actually went to numerous bookstores in town looking for information on Haiti, and I was simply flabbergasted to see that in all the travel sections of all our big bookstores here, there wasn't a single book on Haiti. Even the Caribbean sections had color-coded diagrams for every single country, and Haiti was always blank. So it was just totally new for me. Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously you wouldn't find this in the travel section, but back a few years ago, and I don't know whether you were on the faculty then or not, we chose Mountains Beyond Mountains by Tracy Kidder, which is the story of Dr. Paul Farmer and the work he's done in Haiti and his organization called Partners in Health, and really did a wonderful job of helping us understand Haiti as a country. Now, you only had how much time before this earthquake hit and the time you landed in Haiti?
Well, roughly 3 hours.
3 hours. So it's not like you could develop any pre-earthquake assessment of what the country was all about, and especially since you couldn't find a book.
Right.
Well, obviously, this was a conference you were going to, normally held in Paris or somewhere in France?
Normally held in Saint-Malo, France, which is on the coast of France, for about the past 20 years or so. And in 2007, they held the first Haitian edition. It was a huge success.
And what I thought was just the height of irony is the topic for the roundtable you were to be a part of. Your reason for going was?
The urgency of literature in times of crisis.
I mean, that's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Help me understand. What was the nature of that prior to the earthquake anyway? what did you think the crisis was in the topic you were given?
Well, the authors are going to be on my panel. I was the only academic had written on all types of things. And so I was coming at it from the perspective of my background, which was French Caribbean literature and Albert Camus. And I was thinking perhaps the discussions might be oriented towards how fast does one write in order to get the word out based on any crisis, whether it be political, natural, et cetera, mm-hmm. and what are the repercussions of writing quickly in terms of quality, all types of things.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the fact that the conference was held in Haiti because of the many literary awards that have been given to Haitian authors and their overall prominence. Do you know anything about what happened to the Haitian literary community as a result of this earthquake?
Personally, I was invited because of someone that had come to Boise State 2 years ago, Evelyn Toyo. She came to my class, spoke on campus in numerous venues. And once I got back to the States, I was able to contact her. And I know that she is fine.
She's safe.
Yeah. And a lot of the authors whom I was going to meet for the first time ended up being the same situation I was. So I got to see them, sometimes talk with them during the time I was actually in Haiti. And it appears from the website that a poet and his wife unfortunately died in the earthquake. But aside from that, fortunately, the people that were going there for the conference seemed to have survived.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the hotel where you were staying in Port-au-Prince. Let's get down to those few critical minutes after the earthquake. How would you compare this hotel to the average conference hotel that so many of our faculty or listeners would go to, no matter what their organizational affiliation?
In terms of the conferences that I've been to in the past, this hotel is probably the best one ever, which is perhaps quite ironic because I was in Haiti. But driving there in the taxi, the streets are so crowded with people. It's just they were poor before the earthquake. That's no surprise to anybody. I was seeing it for the first time myself. And when one of the people I was with in the taxi said that the hotel was coming up, I thought, oh, this should be interesting because we're not necessarily in a great part of town, so it seemed. We turned a corner, and there was just this beautiful foyer, just an incredible hotel. Several stories. It was built on a hill, and so it had several different veranda-type terraces that extended down to a seating area, a pool, and then a tennis court.
So you check into the hotel, you go to your room right away, and then what happens?
Go to my room. The first thing I'm thinking is it's been a long trip. I should write my wife. And I turned on my computer, and the Wi-Fi wasn't working, so I went outside.
And it hit.
And that's when it hit. Yeah, I was three lines into an email just explaining what had happened thus far when all of a sudden I realized something had changed.
Well, help us understand that. When I say it hit, what was the feeling? What was the sound? What was your very first reaction as to what was going on at the moment?
I was sitting in kind of like a little cast iron chair around the patio deck, kind of table and chairs, and all of a sudden, things started shaking, and my chair was actually scraping against the rocks on which the chair was placed. And first, I didn't know what it was. And a minute later, I mean, not even a minute, seconds later, the big earthquake hit, and that's when I realized it was an earthquake that was taking place.
Mm-hmm. And I should mention that you said you were trying to reach your wife. Your wife is Dr. Mariah Devereaux Herbeck, who is also a French professor at Boise State. And needless to say, we were in touch with her during those many days. Well, they certainly seemed like 2 weeks instead of the few days it was. But we were in touch with her trying to figure out a way to get you out of there, just as you were trying to figure that out from your end. Now, there were a lot of aftershocks also. As a matter of fact, I think we're still getting reports of some aftershocks. But were there ones that immediately came about after the initial earthquake?
Yeah, the initial earthquake, for me at least, it seemed like it was quite strong, followed by a very strong one seconds later, followed by another somewhat weaker one, which was probably still 5-point-something. And it was during the second phase of that first earthquake that the walls started cracking and everything. And after that, they just kept coming over the course of the entire night and the next day. We had been told by people there, 48 hours, then you're good. And 48 hours later, we were still jumping out of our beds, running for the door.
Mm-hmm. Now, the hotel in which you were staying did not crumble to the ground. There were many cracks, but it was still standing.
It was still standing, yeah.
Obviously, there wasn't anybody in it at that point, I assume. They all blew out of there and didn't go back, right?
Right.
Now, you did have a hotel across the street or somewhere nearby that I think you did see more damage. Did it actually fall?
I hadn't seen it myself, but the Hotel Montana was a place that was also recommended for the conference. And the next day, someone pointed out on the hillside across the ravine where it had been. So it was entirely gone.
So the people in it were more than likely entirely gone.
Yeah.
So who determines whether you wind up in the hotel you chose are the Hotel Montana. How does that happen?
Haven't told anybody this, but a colleague of mine in Florida with whom I was going to room suggested that we stay at the main conference hotel because most of the authors were going to be there. And so I said, why not? Let's give it a shot. And it's thanks to him and getting a reservation in time that I was in the Hotel Caribe.
I guess. That's amazing. Now, it's nighttime, or it's at some point it's nighttime, and you're trying to figure out what you do next. You wind up on a tennis court?
Yeah, that was deemed the flattest, most secure place in the area, with no telephone wires around. And so we were all told to take refuge there for the night.
And when you say we all, the folks who were staying in the hotel on the property?
Right. The hotel staff and all the guests.
Mm-hmm. What's that like? First of all, did you know how many people did you know? And so your buddy from Florida was with you?
He was set to arrive the next day. He never got there.
Oh.
And so I knew nobody there, which made things a bit more scary.
Mm-hmm. What about the language issue? Were the folks who were on the tennis court with you all speaking English?
No. Some of the staff and some of the people from some of the crumbled buildings next door that were huddling there were speaking Creole. Many people were speaking French, and then there was some different American constituencies that were speaking English.
Mm-hmm. So you get to this tennis court, and you're bedded down. What the owner of the hotel or the proprietor decides to find something for you to lay on, even though I'm sure it wasn't a mattress?
He did a miraculous job. He sent some of his staff and himself back into part of the hotel, which I guess was just storage area. And little by little, over the course of the evening and the night, they brought out mattresses. Of course, there weren't enough. And so eventually I was fortunate enough to have a tablecloth as a blanket to sleep on.
A tablecloth over a tennis court. That sounds like a pretty hard sleep to me.
Yeah. I didn't get much sleep.
I guess not. Well, I'm sure you didn't get much sleep for other reasons as well. I mean, you had to be really worried about what was going to happen next. Even by then, I guess you knew you were in the aftershock department. And if you're out away from electrical wires, that you're probably as safe as you can get in Haiti.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was fortunate to have a tennis court there because every time an aftershock hit, I just thought, what would have happened if I had been somewhere else? Mm-hmm. As most people know, it's often the aftershocks that send more things down on people because structures have been destabilized.
What were the sounds like? What was going on around the hotel and what was in the air in terms of what you were having to deal with as you're laying there on a tennis court trying to figure out what's going on in the rest of Haiti beyond your hotel property?
It was a long night, and it came in stages because the first thing, once it started getting dark and people realized we were not going to be leaving and we were going to basically take shelter on the tennis court, we started forming little groups and just discussing what was going on and trying to have some small talk, determining who people were, et cetera. And they didn't want to turn on the generator right away in order to save electricity. And so for a while it was pitch dark and completely quiet. And that was probably one of the most eerie times because there were no sirens whatsoever in this entire city. And I could assume that it was a pretty bad earthquake.
Obviously, since there's no sirens, they haven't even figured out a way to get emergency personnel out on the street. Most of the trucks, whatever they are, were probably demolished in the earthquake.
Yeah.
Well, you referred to this period. I guess it's this period as the scariest 24 hours of my life. What's the most frightening thing that you look back on when you remember those moments?
I think, first of all, I was just shaken up by the earthquake itself. There were numerous aftershocks, as we discussed, but most of the time I realized it was just my legs shaking. I mean, it sounds cliche, but my legs would literally start shaking underneath me just having gone through what I had just experienced. And then subsequent to that, it was the fear of the unknown, not knowing how I was going to get to the airport. It was quite a ways from the airport. I'd already seen the conditions of the streets before the earthquake. I could imagine what had happened in terms of blocking those streets, and I simply didn't know where I was going to go.
Now, fortunately, you hooked up with some folks that really, really helped you figure out where you were going to go, and I think I read one account that you don't give the specific name of the agency they're affiliated with because they really didn't want that kind of publicity. But tell us exactly what happens in that night that allows you to hook up with some folks that eventually help you get out of Haiti, I guess.
As I said before, I didn't know anybody there. And so in the hours following the earthquake, I found myself in a position where I needed to find someone that had a situation somewhat like mine. It sounds selfish, but I knew I needed to find Americans probably, or at least people that wanted to go to the States, because there were so many different types of people there. And so initially I thought it was the Coast Guard. They had some people there at the hotel that had helped us initially on the tennis court. But in the middle of the night, they got up to leave to try to save someone else from their party that hadn't yet made it to the hotel. So it was a search operation, and they had gone. And so over the course of the evening, I was looking for people that might have some type of link with me. And my wife, she described it well afterwards by saying it was kind of like Survivor. I was looking for alliances. And you don't want to alienate anybody because they might actually have the secret or the solution to get out of there. But little by little, I started introducing myself to people and realized that there were a group of Americans there working for a USAID contractor that seemed to have a plan to get out of there.
Mm-hmm. Did you sleep at all that night?
Very little. Mm-hmm. I did sleep some because I had taken a red eye the night before and I was exhausted. But every time things started rattling, glasses would fall over on the tennis courts. It was impossible to sleep through that.
Mm-hmm. So the sun rises on Haiti the next morning, and here you are on this hotel property. What do you do then? And in the sense of moving around and getting a look at what has happened, what's this town look like, Port-au-Prince?
I couldn't see much other than the perspective from the side of the hill where the tennis court was. And I looked out across, and that's where we saw where the Hotel Montana had used to be, or had been, I should say. And that's when I began looking right in back of the hotel. There was a dual apartment structure that had collapsed entirely. And I started talking to a woman there who had escaped with two of her children. Mm-hmm. And I started realizing just how tremendous this earthquake had been.
Did you begin to see then the search and rescue? Did any of that arrive the following morning? Or?
I did not see any search and rescue where I was, and we traveled through Port-au-Prince quite a bit in the 3-4 days I was there. I didn't see any except for the at the airport. Mm-hmm. The search and rescue that was being done by people out of the goodness of their hearts, trying to help friends, relatives, strangers out of the rubble.
Now, when you say you traveled around Port-au-Prince in those 3 or 4 days you were there, was this all part of trying to figure out how to get out or just killing time with, I might as well see what's going on around me? What were you up to?
No, it was trying to find a way out.
Okay.
First of all, we left the hotel the day after the earthquake to go to the headquarters of this USAID contractor. After that, we thought we were going to be going to the airport. We went to the airport. No flights came in. So we're traveling all around basically for 2-3 days. None of it was for sightseeing.
You're listening to Jason Herbick. He is a French professor here at Boise State. And as you can tell, he was in Haiti at the time of the earthquake. And we're just very thankful that he's back with us and thought he might be able to give us some insights into just how horrible a situation we have here in Haiti. The news media from around the world descended on Haiti as soon as they could get there, and you're traveling around Port-au-Prince anyway, watching this relationship between those who have been hurt and killed, and the rescue efforts were carried out. You have some observations, I believe, about how the media itself and the coverage of the event actually does influence, it appears, the reactions that people have. How's that?
That's a big question. There's so many different things I experienced while I was there. One simply has to do with being on the tarmac waiting for my flight the second day I was there and seeing people that had been pulled from the rubble be carried through the airport onto the tarmac waiting their evacuation. And the people that had helped them with this huge rescue, which was so important, were taking cell phones out of their pockets and taking pictures of themselves with this rescued victim. And I felt so thankful that they had rescued this person, but I just felt that there was so precious time that they needed to get back out there and do it again. And the cameras were there, the media, they wanted to have interviews with how this person was rescued. I can definitely understand why this has to be done, to get the word out, to explain why people are in such dire straits. But at the same time, you don't see all the time it takes to prepare a program that, for me at least, on the ground, I felt could be better used going back out into the rubble and searching for more people.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, then for the rest of the time, you were staying at the headquarters of this USAID organization?
During the day, and then at night, we would be taken by four-wheel drive vehicles to other houses in the area because they considered the headquarters not stable enough should another aftershock hit, and there was no place to sleep outside.
So you did end up staying inside a house, at least for maybe the third and fourth day or something you were down there?
Yeah.
Did you have any problem getting back inside any kind of a dwelling in Haiti?
It's funny how your mentality changes. No longer did I leave the door, did I close the door when going to the bathroom. I did not take any showers, even though one was proposed to me. I slept, despite the fact that there were numerous accommodations in this house that I was at, I slept on a couch 10 feet from the door. I was obviously in a state where I wasn't going to take any chances.
Sure. Did you have adequate food and water during this period, the entire period you were stranded in Haiti?
We ate very little food except for at night twice at the houses that we were staying. Water, fortunately, we did have water, yeah. Very little food, which is another interesting story in the sense that often when I was sitting somewhere and kneeling, I thought there was another earthquake happening, and I realized that my stomach was empty and my heart was beating so fast that, in fact, it was simply once again me scaring myself.
We heard reports of looting. Did you see much of that?
There was some at the hotel. Someone tried to apparently break into the hotel the first night, which was somewhat frightening. But overall, no. And I think given that we had access to CNN in subsequent nights, it was kind of strange to see some of the fear factors that were playing into this unruly city going out of control, because for the most part, driving around town, people were very passive. They were doing their best to get on with what they were doing, whether it be find food, etc., talking with the people, comforting each other. I did not see the same level of looting. In fact, if you don't mind, I have one quote that I brought today.
Sure.
And it was written by one of the authors that received a prestigious prize this year in literature, and who was at the conference, and whom I saw on the tennis courts the next day. And he, as many of the authors are there, which comes back to the roundtable discussion, the urgency of literature in times of crisis, they've all been contacting their respective newspapers, journals, etc. And so on a site that I've been following, he wrote about this looting, and I translated it, and he said, when people risking their life go into the rubble in search of something to eat or drink before cranes come to demolish everything, that doesn't amount to looting but to surviving. There will certainly be looting later because every city has its share of outlaws, but up until now what I've seen is only what people do to survive, and I could not agree more.
You mentioned something in one of the interviews you had about this experience of this singing, these children singing. I think it might have been during your first night on the tennis mm-hmm. court. Help us understand how people, including children, reacted to this crisis.
The singing came, yes, when I was on the tennis court that first night, and it was before they turned on the generator, so it was completely quiet. And all of a sudden, there was this, what I thought initially was screaming and yelling, but I realized as this group, which must have been walking through the streets in the middle of the night, they were actually singing and praying, singing prayers, I should say. And it sounded mostly like it was children, maybe women as well. And it was just this most determined, defiant singing I'd ever heard. And it was very eerie to hear that coming out of the darkness down below in Port-au-Prince, knowing that down there, probably even a lot worse than what I'd experienced.
Well, the quake hit on a Tuesday, and you were able to get a flight out on Friday, but that wasn't exactly the end of your journey. Did you go to the Dominican Republic, and then from there, How did you eventually get back to Boise? I know it didn't happen overnight because we were monitoring that part of your trip.
We eventually had a small chartered flight out of Port-au-Prince to a small airport in the DR, East La Bella, I think. And from there, we took a taxi through Santo Domingo, the capital, to another airport and took a flight from there through Atlanta to D.C.
Did you notice when you were moving from Haiti to the Dominican Republic, I've read some reports about the stark contrast between the two countries. Did you see any of that? Could you see the contrast?
That's an excellent question. I'd seen pictures myself, aerial photos of the border. And instead of seeing like on a map a yellow line, you can see where the trees begin in the DR. And that's exactly what I saw from the plane. And someone said, yes, that's the border. It's true. Haiti has been largely deforested over the years. And in fact, it was 85 and hot when I left Port-au-Prince. And when I arrived at the airport in the DR, which was only an hour-long flight at most, it was raining. It was just incredible. The topography was the same, and yet the climate had changed entirely.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's been so much written about Haiti and what's happened to it over the centuries. It apparently is the only country where a slave revolt actually worked and succeeded in overthrowing the rulers. But in the meantime, of course, there's been so many people writing in the national news media about Haiti and the role that its own history played in the construction of buildings, the quality of the infrastructure, what role that might have played in the numbers of deaths. Obviously, you could see the turmoil and you could see the destruction all around you. I'm just curious if when you see these relief organizations in there, if there's any way that you can actually gauge how much more difficult it was because it was a country that was so poverty stricken.
I think the surpopulation was a major aspect, a major obstacle in providing relief. There's so many people there. They build houses very often right next to one another. So many people in the streets to begin with. There was, in terms of infrastructure, it was very difficult, I think, to even start to comprehend how to get resources throughout the city.
One final question I have to ask, now that you're back here for a couple of weeks, does anything change in your perception of the catastrophe and your experiences as you come back and think through these things? Even in terms of the way most of us are led to believe things are unfolding in Haiti, given your own personal experience. Any difference there?
I think that what concerns me most has to do with the way in which all the relief is going to be handled. I've read a lot of interesting articles about the fact that we need to, in providing relief, allow Haitians to have jobs that are going to help themselves rebuild, to give them money in their pocket, to allow them to truly start rebuilding their lives and not just have contractors from outside come in and build the roads, the buildings, etc., because then they'll be back to where they started. And I think of all the things that I've read and watched since I've been back, I think that's what's most important to me at this point, is to find ways in which the Haitian people can help rebuild their own country, because they definitely want to. They're a proud people. I spoke with many of them while I was there, and I think they want nothing more than to receive help, but also to help themselves.
Well, speaking of how we can help them, I've already mentioned Partners in Health. There's the American Red Cross, UNICEF, and I know so many people listening have already done it their own way, the United Nations Foundation. But Bronco Nation can also show support for earthquake victims by purchasing T-shirts which sport the familiar Bronco Athletic logo on the front, and the words Bronco Nation Cares are on sale at the bookstore. There's also a map of Haiti on the back. By the way, it's $9.95. $5 from each sale will be donated to the St. Alphonsus Foundation for Project Haiti, another great cause. Jason Herbeck, it's so nice to have you with us today on New Horizons, and most importantly, to have you back in the Boise State community. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Next week, world-renowned security technologist Bruce Schneier talking about how to keep information safe in the digital age. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons.